Welcome to Pieces of Choice, the podcast where we explore how conscious awareness can help us cultivate inner peace and transform our lives. I'm Natasha Wallace, and in each episode, we'll hear from guests about their personal journeys, the challenges they've faced, and how they've found greater levels of peace in their lives and positively impacted the lives of others. So today I'm joined by Claire Libby, a certified health coach, director at LINAC Learning, a learning and development consultancy, and founder of I Am Me, the community interest company supporting the mental health and well-being of young people. Through her free app, Claire offers teenagers and young adults tools, tips and insights to help them take an active role in their own well-being with a focus on prevention before issues escalate. Now, the app came from a very personal place. Claire grew up with an alcohol-dependent mother who never had the guidance or role models to help her look after her own mental health and well-being. That had a huge impact on Claire's life growing up, and it left her wishing her mum had access to the kind of support that might have changed her life trajectory. Out of that experience, the I Am Me app was born to give young people today the tools and guidance her mum never had. Welcome to the Pieces of Choice podcast. I'm so looking forward to talking to you today.
I'm so excited to be here, Natasha. It's lovely to see you again.
Great. Well, should we just get straight into it?
Crack on.
Our childhood experiences often shape who we become, and I know that's especially true for you. Can you tell us about your early life and how it shaped the choices you made both growing up and later into adulthood?
Yeah, I think it's something I'm probably still unravelling. I just celebrated my 50th birthday, and I think it's something that more than anything I've just got really curious about. But there are kind of key things that jump out that I can now anchor back to moments when I was younger and see how patterns have formed, emerged, and it's hugely shaped not only the work I do, as you alluded to, but it's shaped the relationships I've gone on to form. It's shaped the way I parent my boys. But something that came to light more recently was that anchoring back to when I probably first experienced that stress response, so fight, flight or freeze. And I think I was probably about 6 years old, and it was kind of a full-on experience. I was in my room, probably about to go to sleep, and was woken up to a big thud. My dad wasn't at home. My sister must have been at a friend's or something. And I remember kind of stepping out into our hallway, and mum was just kind of comatose on the floor, passed out completely. And I remember it because anyone that grew up in the 70s might remember those hideous, highly flammable dressing gowns that we were put in. And I had one of those on, and highly flammable slippers as well. So I put those on, and bearing in mind at that point we lived in the countryside, pretty remote, in Bedfordshire.
Right.
But my nan lived in a cottage, probably 600 yards up the road. So obviously come out full on panic, seen my mum on the floor, not knowing what to do. She wasn't responsive. And I somehow thought it was a good idea to get on my Falcon Pro BMX bike and pedal my little legs up to my nan's house. And it's only now that I can see that kind of full on fight, flight, freeze response was, you know, putting adrenaline into my system, not really thinking about the consequences of my action, you know, no lights, remote country road, young kid on their own, going up to my nan's house. Unfortunately, I'd forgotten she was away, so pedaled back again. Mum managed to kind of come round and stagger into bed. But, you know, that kind of high alert, I think, has probably stayed with me on and off since that moment. So in terms of kind of what that looks like today, up until recently, I would be prepared for anything to go wrong. That's been kind of my response to life. I would be on the lookout for people's behaviours, their body language, you know, their patterns of behaviour, kind of trying to make sense of it to prevent anything from going on, protecting myself, protecting my kids.
Yeah.
And that's exhausting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess the knock-on effect of that is, you know, a battered immune system, you know, your adrenal glands are shot to pieces. Mm. And I would say it's only probably in the last sort of 15 years or so that I've made that really informed decision and realized actually life doesn't have to be like that. Yes, those childhood experiences have hugely impacted me, but I don't have to, it doesn't have to play out like that. So the last 15 years, I would say, have been about trying to get out of my head a lot more, and connecting with my heart, connecting with my breath, connecting with the present moment. And as I said, it's continuous, but those are the things, that kind of hypervigilant behavior. I think anyone that goes through traumatic experiences, and that was just one example.
Yeah.
You know, it can't help but have that impact on you to make you kind of be ready for things to go wrong rather than excited for things to go right. So yeah, that's been a real mindset game for me, definitely.
Yeah. And I mean, I can imagine that memory as well from your childhood is sort of filled with fear.
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting because there was a huge amount of shame around mum's drinking. And it's really quite bizarre. And I think that's just a sign of the times, how we are more open about addiction and mental health. You know, I don't remember anyone ever saying that mum had a mental health condition or mum was an addict. It was very much, I don't know if that's a sign of the 70s and 80s, your mum just drinks too much, you know, but there's a history of alcohol dependency in her family. Yeah. So it just baffles me that no one thought, you know, maybe we need to explore this a little bit, or even, you know, checking in with my sister and I, you know, how are you after that experience? If that happened today, you know, schools would be involved. You know, you'd probably have family members, friends, you know, people would be aware and there would be that support network. But, you know, that example, the next day, it was just life as normal, you know, as if nothing happened. And I think that probably created a part of me that wasn't very good at showing emotion, because I was never given an opportunity to demonstrate that. You know, it was pretty bizarre looking back. If I think about my own boys, probably the other extreme, you know, we'd be kind of discussing it, unpicking it. Whereas there, it's kind of like, right, off to school, off you go. So it's had a huge impact, and it's not all negative. You know, it's really given me drive and purpose. It's made me hugely resilient. So there are things to be thankful for if you delve deep enough and unpick them.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because you're bringing a thought to mind for me. The former CEO of Ford, who there was a massive turnaround of Ford, you know, a decade or so ago, and Alan Mulally was the guy behind it. And he talks about expect the unexpected and expect to deal with it. And when I heard that, I thought that's such a beautiful sentiment, because it doesn't feel like it's coming from a position of fear. It feels like it's just a recognition that life happens and things happen that we weren't expecting and we have to deal with them. But that's a very different sentiment from operating in survival mode from a position of fear, where you have learned to protect yourself because you have to. And it feels like that's what your childhood experience has sort of given you.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think it's almost been a reparenting process, because that emotional support wasn't there. I don't want to paint a picture that I wasn't cared for. You know, my mum and my dad did what they could with what they knew at the time. You know, we always lived, we had a roof over our head, we had food on the table, we had holidays, but it was kind of weird looking back that it was almost like there was this normal existence, but this really dark side that no one really spoke about. But I think it's very much, you know, been a process of actually, what can I take from that? And it's made me curious, like really curious as to why why I react to things in a certain way. So I would say that's the greatest gift that it's given me, that if something, you know, annoys me or I get irritated by something, it's, I start to kind of unpick it, go, what is it about that? You know, is it just that I'm tired and cranky? No, it's not actually. That really bothers me. Why does that bother me? And then you go on this kind of like, you know, secret hunt to work out and understand yourself more. And I think, you know, that's probably what we're here to do, to unpick everything and really work out kind of what's in here and what matters to us. So, yeah, it's been an interesting 50 years.
Well, and so obviously those early experiences led you to create I Am Me and build what is a very purpose-driven business. How did that end up happening?
It was quite a slow process. I was working at the time for a company, had the most amazing boss, and he was really passionate about helping young people. And it was very much around how they can transition from education to work. So I had a lot of interaction with young people, and there were a lot of young people working in our office. And you just started to notice that people that were once really confident, outgoing, just started to shrink a little bit in themselves. And it was around the time that more and more celebrities were starting to talk about mental health. And I just, again, became interested and curious about why was that happening? What was going on in the lives of young people? And obviously, I've got two boys who were younger at the time, and some of their friends were really struggling. So it was out of curiosity more than anything. And then that connected with, you know, I wonder if my mum's life could have been different had she had someone at home that knew about this sort of stuff, or were there support services in place? So it was a series of focus groups, discussions with teachers, educators, employers, to kind of understand what was going on and, importantly, what young people needed at that particular time. And from the focus groups that I ran with them, they were adamant they didn't want a book. They didn't want to sit, you know, on a school bus or something and for everyone to see what they were reading. So the app was really born out of their desire to keep their understanding and learning about themselves private until they felt like they either needed to get support or they could get their heads around about, you know, what was happening to them and how they could potentially support themselves.
Yeah, okay. And how does I Am empower young people to take care of themselves?
I would say it's about having a role model where potentially role models are lacking. And that's not to do a disservice to any kind of families, but I think sometimes, you know, it can be difficult to put words to how you're feeling. So it's something that can be carried around in their back pocket because every young person has a phone. And it's a way for them to start to connect with themselves, to understand themselves a bit better, and to work out actually how they're feeling. Because I think so often, particularly in today's world, we're kind of living life through other people's lenses, that we bypass our own emotions, our own thoughts and feelings. So it's a way for them to go through a series of articles, activities, trackers, and connect with themselves more. And then ideally from a preventative point of view, so rather than waiting for things to escalate so that they really do need quite a severe intervention, it's about helping them to want to take care of themselves from a young age, which I think is critical.
Have you got an example or story that you could share with us of somebody whose life it has impacted?
Yes, I have. There's one young lady that springs to mind who I was connected with through a charity I support in London called the Young Urban Arts Foundation. Mm-hmm. And this particular young lady was struggling with disordered eating. She was bounced backwards and forwards from her GP. And she was, first of all, I think she was told that it wasn't severe enough, which does one thing, and it makes a young person think, I need to make it more severe to get the help that I need to get. So she was then put on a waiting list and was told it would be 12 months until she got the support that she needed. So I stepped in as in a role as a health coach,
just so that she could have someone to speak to. I have no experience of disordered eating, and nor did I pretend that I did. It was literally just using me as a sounding board. And we would have catch-ups every couple of weeks online. We would do video calls, check in with her, and we worked through a lot of the stuff that's on the app. And we were able to get her some support privately, which was funded through my company, so that she was able to get seen sooner whilst the NHS stuff was going on in the background. And she is absolutely thriving. She is incredible. I still speak to her today. I've got a call with her tomorrow to check in. She's just incredible, absolutely incredible. And she's taken, and all I think it was for her was about learning how to regulate her nervous system, because what was happening is that the emotions were spiraling and she was feeling out of control. So simple things like breath work, you know, thinking about how she was using her time, stepping away from social media, all those sorts of things, you know, it's really simple stuff. And yeah, she is incredible.
Well, that's amazing. And of course, no doubt exactly the reason why you do the work that you do. What led her to reach that point in the first place?
It was a whole host of things, home life, environment, issues with school, with friends, perception of herself, you know, what I would imagine a lot of young people experience. But it just all came together at the same time and just spiraled for her.
Yeah. Okay.
So there wasn't one particular thing. It was lots of different things.
And how do you think the challenges facing young adults today differ from maybe what we were experiencing when we were younger?
First and foremost, we got more opportunity to switch off from them. You know, when we went to school, if we had an issue at school, when we came home, we were in a safe space, hopefully. People didn't have access to our thoughts, feelings and emotions that they do through social media. And I'm not a doom goblin as far as social media comes, but it does infiltrate you know, a person's life if it's not kind of managed properly. I think for me that's the biggest difference. We had more headspace as kids. We weren't you know, glued to smartphones. We were most likely kicked out and told to go and play in the garden, and you know, we'd come back when we were hungry. So I think it is incredibly different. And I think, you know, a lot of certainly if I think about my father and his views, you know, there is this kind of like, we didn't have these problems when I was growing up. It's like it was a completely different time. You cannot compare the two. You know, it's technology is fantastic, but it's also got a really dark side to it, I think.
Yeah, and of course it plays on our addictive 100%. Personalities and our need for dopamine and all those sorts of things.
Yeah, I think there's actually only two industries that refer to their customers as users, and that's the tech industry and the illegal drugs industry. So I think that gives you a an idea of what's going on, you know. And this is coming from me, and I've created an app, but I think my app's probably one of the only apps that tries to push people away from it.
Yeah, well, and I mean, there's a difference between using tech for good,
yeah,
and capitalizing on human, yeah, desire and addiction to make money.
Yeah.
So there's a worrying statistic that was presented to me, which that 50% of mental health conditions are established by the age of 14. You know, what's going on?
Yeah, I think that I always find that really alarming, and it does kind of send a bit of a shiver down my spine, because our childhoods are supposed to be kind of a really carefree time of life. You know, we don't have that financial obligation, we're not responsible for anyone else. But I think this has been a long time coming. I don't think it's something that's happened kind of overnight. I think as human beings, you know, our external environment is really played havoc with our physiology. Once upon a time, life was pretty simple, tough but simple. You know, we would work when it was daylight and we would sleep when it was dark. And then a bright spark invented the light bulb, which meant that, you know, we could carry on, we could push ourselves. Industry pushed us, we delivered on it. And I think that's been kind of a gradual thing. More and more people are experiencing burnout, and that kind of lifestyle is what young people know. You know, that kind of just constantly pushing, not connecting with yourself, being connected with, you know, the external environment rather than your internal environment. And I think it's something that's been kind of working behind the scenes for a long time. And then, you know, we've got the smartphone issues that we have. I think it was 2011, it was about a third of the UK population owned smartphones and about 50% of the US. And that year, the medical profession saw an increase in cases of anxiety amongst teenagers. So there is a direct correlation. And it's kind of, I think people are waking up to that now. But also, I think there's, with that, more people are happy to talk about their mental health. So there is that greater awareness.
Yeah. I think it's really hard as a parent to know how to navigate all of this. I find it quite complex myself. Even simple things like, I dropped my kids off at school this morning. And apart from the fact that one of my daughters couldn't find any of her PE kit to start with. So, and then I was thinking, is that a me problem, or is that a lesson? You know, should she be taking more responsibility for her stuff, or should I have sorted that out? So that was the first thing. And then I go through these waves of like guilt and then thinking, no, hold on, you know, she needs to take ownership, etc. She's only 11. And then we got to school, dropped them off. I was driving home and she phoned me and said, I forgot my homework. And I was like, oh. So, I mean, I was a little bit stressed this morning. And normally I work really hard to be emotionally regulated. And I didn't do very well at that this morning.
Yeah.
So that call came after, you know, a number of different things that already happened this morning. So I was already feeling a little bit wound up. So I, you know, I did the typical parent thing, which is, you know, you should have remembered, you know, you need to get better at this, all that sort of stuff. And then I was faced with a decision. Do I take this homework in for her? She had her friend in the background saying, you're going to get a detention. Detention's really scary. Do I take this homework in for her, or do I allow this to be a lesson? And of course, we work in the learning space, and I know that learning comes from two places. It either comes from pain or it comes from aspiration to do better. So I thought, is this a pain point that she will learn from and she won't ever forget it again? Or am I being really brutal because she's just started secondary school and she's trying to remember all sorts of things, and she remembered her new hockey stick this morning and her, you know, we had to form her mouth guard in her mouth and all of that sort of other stuff. So she hasn't built the habit yet of doing all of these new things. And then I spent the whole car drive home thinking, what was the right thing to do there? Was the right thing to do there to say, lesson learned, in future, bring your homework in, get your stuff ready the night before. I'll bring it in once I've finished my podcast with Claire. Or do I say no? Like, you're gonna have to suffer today. Like, today is where you're gonna learn a lesson, and it's gonna come from a position of pain, and you will never forget your homework again. And I don't even know, what's the answer, Claire? Like, what is the answer?
Yeah, and I do not, you know, I'm by no means parent of the year. I think, you know, like you said, she's young, she's got a lot to get her head round and consider. I can only speak to what I would do, and I would probably take the book in. That's not to say that it's right.
Yeah.
And I think there's kind of, it's almost like pick your battles, isn't it? You know, there's those kind of small wins and those big wins, those small battles and those big battles. I think when we're kind of swooping in, I think they refer to it as helicopter parenting, and stopping our kids from experiencing difficult times because we're trying to protect them, I think that's very different, because actually they've got their own life and their own story to create. And by us coming in, we're kind of preventing that from happening. And one thing I say to my two boys is that they are resilient because they've had to adjust and deal with some really difficult times.
Yeah.
And I see that they're resilient, and I see that they're emotionally intelligent and all the things that I would hope that they would be. So I think it's about picking, you know, what life lesson this is going to be. You know, my boys are 22 and 18 and they still forget stuff. So, you know, I'm not in any position to comment on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is, you don't want to be punitive and punish them. And at the same time, you want to give them the opportunity to learn and grow and build their resilience. Yeah. I feel that it's a constant navigating, you know, you're constantly navigating that.
You are. And I do wonder whether that's an us thing, because I think certainly I can speak from my own experience. You know, I didn't really go to my parents for anything. I didn't rely on them for anything. I didn't really tell them about difficulties that I was experiencing. I kind of got on with it. I'm not saying that's right, but I think that's a sign of the times that as we've had to evolve as young adults and then going into being parents, we've probably become more aware of all of these challenges. So the style of parenting's probably changed a lot over the last 10, 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, as the world changes, we're changing. But I think if we can allow our kids to have their own experiences, I think that can only be a good thing, because it's kind of what's meant for them, obviously not with them suffering, but those challenges, it's important that they see that they can work through them and they can, you know, thrive in them on the other side.
So how would you advise a parent who was trying to figure out how to support their child who was experiencing some sort of mental health difficulty?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. I think, I can't remember who said it, but I heard someone say that your kids will never treat themselves the way that you treat them. They will treat themselves the way you treat yourself. And I think it comes back, whether that is a parent or a leader in business, it comes back to role model behavior. Mm. If you can't make the time to show up for yourself, take care of yourself, you know, number one, you can't show up for other people. And it's really diluting the message about how important it is to take care of your well-being. I think well-being is such a like a bleh word. It's so like, if you say the word disease, everyone sits up and pays attention. But, you know, well-being, it's just a bit like, it's a bit wishy-washy. It doesn't pack the punch that it should. You know, the consequences of not having good well-being are huge. I think, you know, for a parent who's got a young one struggling, I would say where possible, and this is my own experience and research, family meal times are a really good place to be. It doesn't have to be every night. If you can manage it once or twice a week, fantastic. But a time where you're around a table together, you're sitting and eating something that is giving you some nutrition. And it just provides a space where people can ask questions and talk. And if you've never done it before, it's going to be a bit awkward and your kids are going to probably want to eat and go as quickly as possible. But in time, it becomes a space where you know it's going to happen. It's that routine. I think if parents can not be glued to their phones, it's a good message to their kids. And I think, you know, sort of introducing, if I think back to if I was doing my time all over again before I had kids, I would think really carefully about, almost like you would with a business, what do you want your family culture to be? What are your values? What behaviours do you want to instill? And that's not being regimented. That's just giving thought to it. I think for so many of us, we fall into being parents and we kind of muddle through what we every day to just kind of get through it.
Yeah.
You know, we're not in the kind of privileged position to really give it thought. So I think, first and foremost, to the parent, take care of yourself, make time for yourself, make sure you're in a good place, and just try and have some time to connect with your kids, whether that be weekends, you know, kicking a ball about, running, walking, whatever it might be, just 20 minutes so that you can just check in, and you'll know if something's up, and then just start to make inquiries about what support is available if it's needed.
It's so interesting what you say about take care of yourself as the parent first. It's almost this idea of putting your oxygen mask on. And there's research now that shows us, because you talked about leadership as well, that leaders are the number one, or leadership well-being is the number one influencer of organisational performance. So that isn't any massive surprise, isn't it? You know, if a leader's feeling good and they're energised and they're thriving and they're positive, etc., they will have a positive influence on the people around them. And then there's research that says that 73% of leaders are burnt out. You know, and I, although I had my terrible burnout episode 8 years ago, I skirt very close to the edge of burnout too often. As leaders, business owners do, you know, there's this reality, and this is a parent problem too, because I would say the majority of leaders are parents. The reality is that it's not a capability problem. You've just got too much to do. You know, there isn't enough time and you don't have enough capacity to do everything that you need to do. That is the biggest problem. This isn't about leaders not being capable. You know, normally they're the most capable. And it causes huge issues, doesn't it? This is a real problem for leaders slash parents. Because if you're burnt out and then you're trying to show up for your children in a way that's meaningful and engaging and you're present and you're not being constantly distracted by the pressures of work and maybe even home, I think that presents us with a new era of challenge. Because how do you take care of yourself as a parent who's just overstretched? Mm. And most of us are.
Yeah, I think one of the words that I agree with everything you've said, and it's really interesting when you think about parents and that connection with leadership. I think the word that really jumps out is being present. And I, hand on heart, can admit that I wasn't present for a lot of my kids' childhoods. That doesn't mean I wasn't physically present, but mentally present, I was checked out. You know, there was stuff going on in the background, you know, as most people have to deal with. So I think there's stuff that I've learned over the years, but I'm not willing to not do.
Yeah.
To take care of myself. And that's not me saying I've got it nailed and my life is perfect. You know, I have to bend and flex. Last night was a shocking night for sleep. So, you know, there's stuff that you change because, you know, you have to. Nothing goes the way you want it to all the time. But I think for me, if it's about being consistent. You know, we know from neuroplasticity that we can change our thoughts, our behaviours. So it's I think it's not an excuse now to say, actually, you know, this is who I am, sort of lump me or leave me. It's kind of like we can change if we really want to. And I think for me, the work I do, whether it's with young people, middle aged, you know, older people, it's about getting them to connect to how they want to feel. So not, you know, what they want to look like, where they want to be in 5 years' time. How do they want to feel? How do they currently feel? And how do they want to feel? And then they have a choice with every decision they make during that 24-hour window. Is this taking me closer to how I want to feel, or is it taking me further away from how I want to feel? And that's the principles that I operate on. So for me, I want to feel more ease. So, you know, my morning, my evening, any opportunity I get on breaks is about that. And if it's going to spiral me in the other direction, it's a flat no. Obviously I fit my work in during the day like anyone else does, but there are things that I choose to do and I make time for, because that feeling that way is really important to me. So I would suggest that anyone, parent, leader, whoever, just takes a few minutes to think about how they currently feel and how they want to feel and the actions they can take in between those two spaces.
And of course, I mean, we work in the sort of similar space, but doing different things. So I work with leaders on their well-being. And of course, you work with younger people, but also have a learning and development business too. It's the inner work that I often see has the, you know, the biggest impact. You can do all the things on the outside, and you need to, you know, you need to make time and you need to be disciplined and you need to have structure and you need to take care of yourself. And as you and I have both experienced, there's a whole chasm of beliefs and values and limiting beliefs and self-understanding and biases, all sorts of sort of stuff that unless you get under the skin of those, it can be hard to make the lasting change. I mean, would you agree?
100%, 100%. And I think it's everything that we're kind of dealing with on the surface is a symptom. It's not the cause. And I think, you know, when the time is right for anyone, they'll start to want to understand the cause, because the moment you can kind of wrap your head around that, then those symptoms will start to kind of just get weaker and weaker and weaker, and you can then sort of change things. I think it's critical, you know. I think that, and I think more people do that. And it's not about blaming your parents for everything that's gone wrong in your life, but it is kind of trying to make sense of the person that you are at this moment in time and what has led you to think and behave in that way. And then, you know, realizing you've got a choice. It doesn't have to go on for the next 50 years in the same way. You can choose again. And I think that's really important.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I guess, considering your reactions to the environment that you're in. I mean, there's a brilliant book called Sitting in the Fire by Arnold Mindell, who has sadly passed. But he did sort of global mediation work and conflict, all that sort of stuff. And the Sitting in the Fire book is about this concept of, like, often we have to sit in the fire. Like, we can't change what's happening. We can't leave the job. We can't leave our children, certainly, but, you know, we can't change the fundamentals of what is happening around us, but we can change how we see it. And, you know, just going back to the young girl that you were talking about earlier on, you know, that sounded like a mindset shift.
Yeah, I think it was a whole host of things. It was coping strategies, it was seeing that she wasn't at fault. So yeah, it's a whole host of things. And I think for me, you know, thinking about the kind of stuff that I've done over the last 15, 20 years, the biggest thing I've noticed is that I am less reactive. So I am able to pause, even if it's for a split second, and I can think about how I want to respond to a situation. Whereas before, because I was on high alert, it was kind of like, right, you know, I'm in there and I'm reacting to these things rather. Now it's not always perfect, but you know, there's definitely that moment where I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. And then I'll, you know, think about the words that are going to come out of my mouth.
Yeah, yeah. And that's where we find the peace, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, that's ultimately, you know, like what this podcast is all about.
Yeah.
Through really understanding yourself and becoming more consciously aware, you have more choice. I mean, I've got to admit, I mean, I've been doing this work for 8 years now. I'm the same as you. I definitely am much more conscious and I have much more choice and I'm very much more intentional about the decisions I'm making. It doesn't mean I feel like that all the time. I still get triggered. I still get scared. You know, things will happen and I get pushed back into this very primal survival mode. I now know what's happening. I might not be able to come out of it straight away. It doesn't mean you solve everything, does it? It just means that you're more aware of it.
100%. And then I think it's about what you do with that. So for me, you know, I start my day and I end my day with breath work and meditation. And believe me, when I started it, I would sit there for like 2 minutes and it would feel like 10 years. My mind was just like constantly chitter-chattering, hated every second of it. But now I look forward to it because I can actually feel that calmness and that peace coming over me. So regardless of what happens in the middle of my day, those are two opportunities I know where I can just feel that calm. And it feels really nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, for anybody who hasn't explored breath work or meditation, it sounds a little bit woo-woo and a bit like the sort of thing that hippies do if you haven't experienced it. But I mean, it's not. It's just a very grounding thing to do, isn't it?
It just regulates your nervous system, you know, and if you're a stressed out, burnt out person, it's for me, it's free and simple to do. So it's completely underrated in my view.
Well, and also tell us about lifestyle medicine, because that's something else that you do. I mean, for those of us who know nothing about it, what does it mean?
So it's a term that is used by the medical profession. So I think more often now we're seeing, so if I were to present with symptoms of heart palpitations or, you know, high blood pressure. If I went to my doctor, more often than not, they start to ask you questions about what stress you might be experiencing, what your sleep's like, how much exercise you get. So it's really just piecing together your lifestyle choices and seeing the significance that they can have on your overall health. So that's why it's stuff that we really, for the most part, have a choice around. So whatever decisions we're making, they then impact the quality of our life. So it's things like your stress, how you deal with it, sleep, nutrition, movement, your relationships. You know, they kind of create who we are. And it's about trying to align them all up as best possible to give you that whole self and that kind of person that you want to be and how you want to feel. So yeah, it's really simple. More often than not, it's all like free stuff other than the food that you're buying. So it's hugely impactful. And I think for a lot of people that are kind of, that do have too much on their plate, those simple changes can be really significant in terms of how they feel and how they show up in the world for themselves and other people as well. So yeah, it's really critical, I think.
And for anybody listening who wants to give some thought to this, what would you suggest they do to consider how they might make some improvements in their lifestyle?
I would say, first and foremost, connect with how you're currently feeling, how you want to feel. And then I would look at each of the different areas of lifestyle medicine. So consider how stressed you're currently feeling and think about what causes you stress, how it presents itself in you, because it's different for everyone. I tend to get a lot of tension, headaches and tight neck. Other people get kind of sicky feelings in their stomach. You know, it could be a whole host of things. Sleep, you know, rating the quality of sleep in terms of how long it takes to go to sleep, how if they stay asleep and how rested they feel when they wake up. Do a bit of a relationship analysis in terms of the relationships you have, personal and work. Is there anything that's kind of jumping out that you feel needs work, needs addressing? I would think about the amount of movement that we're getting. I think, you know, we've gone from kind of having movement as a natural part of our existence to I'm going to go to the gym and then I'm going to sit at my desk all day. So for me, movement is very much about how you can get the blood flowing on a daily basis, how you can process difficult emotions. And that's something I connected with deeply when I was younger. So movement allowed me to get out of my head and move and process really challenging emotions. And, you know, where possible on breaks, on lunch breaks, whatever it might be, just walking, moving, getting the blood flowing. Anything that's to do with nutrition, you know, trying to avoid ultra processed foods, anything that's kind of rammed with chemicals and antibiotics, and eating food as nature intended it to be presented to us, and trying to eat seasonally where possible. You know, it doesn't have to be, that applies to all budgets. You know, you can get packets of frozen berries, vegetables, doesn't have to be fresh and organic. So trying to get as much proper food in there as possible because of that connection between the gut and the brain. You know, our food does literally influence how we feel. It influences mood. So those are some things that I would recommend that people look at.
Great. Fantastic. There's plenty to go at there. And then in terms of the future, what changes do you think we need to see in terms of how we approach mental health as a society?
For me, it's a big one. it's a cultural shift. And it comes back to kind of, I think, bringing new life into this world, giving thought to before people become parents, thinking about their own mental health and well-being first and foremost. Is it the right time? Are they ready? What changes can they make to their own lifestyle? Because they then become the role models for the future. You know, and I feel it's got to become something that is so ingrained in our society that it's second nature for people to take care of themselves. There are other countries that do it really well. I don't think we do in this country at all. I think it's something that's almost seen as for the wealthy and the privileged, but it comes back to basics. It's kind of that natural evolution that we should all be using to thrive. So I think for me, it's role model behavior wherever possible, and helping young people just become aware of themselves, connect with themselves, and want to take care of themselves rather than leaving it till something goes wrong.
Okay, that's great advice. And for anybody who wants to get hold of you, find out more, where do they go?
Probably two main places would be IME Global on Instagram. That's where we kind of put out new articles that are on the app, positive words to hopefully lift someone's day, but not being kind of like too optimistic and unrealistic. Like to keep it real in that respect. And I'm on LinkedIn, Claire Libby. I don't tend to do much on social media personally, other than kind of share pictures with my family. So I'm a bit dull in that respect. But those are the two places.
And who would want to work with you? So in terms of the work that people would come to you for, what would it be?
So people come to me from a personal place. So all age ranges, depending on what they're dealing with, helping them work through their own lifestyle choices and tweak them as needed, to connect with themselves, to understand themselves better. And I work with lots of organisations, from apprenticeships right up to CEOs, you know, with supporting their well-being and helping them. So anyone and everyone. I work with charities. I do a lot of free work for young people. So yeah, my door is always open.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I'm sure the audience will have gained some really, really useful insights from you sharing your experience and your story today. So thank you so much, Claire.
Thank you. It's been lovely to see you.
Thank you for listening to Pieces of Choice. For any information on what we've covered in today's episode, and to connect with my guests, head to the show notes. It would be great if you could rate and review the podcast and subscribe now so you don't miss out on any future episodes.